give up the fight. Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know what life is really worth. It's a hard that Peter cold.
Listeners, this is KBOO, your local community radio station, and the program is Proverbial Perspectives. During this particular series of Proverbial Perspectives, we're doing something called the Community Forum on the Political Process. The idea is, I think you've heard it, I've heard it, and all of us have heard it, that there's always an important need for the citizens and the taxpayers to be more and more informed about not just the specific issues, although those are really critical, but a lot of the contextual information that helps people make decisions when they get ready to go for to the voting booth or, oh, nowadays to your mailbox to fill out your ballots. And we have two very active, very interesting people that's going to be discussing a variety of ideas. And I want you to keep in mind that this is a call-in show. So later on, after we get rolling and you begin to hear things that pique your interest, you want to dial 503-231-8187. To my right, we have a longtime activist that many of you will know. His name is Bruce Broussard. And Bruce, say hello to the folks.
How's it going, family?
All right. And here's another very popular, very famous person who is active. And by the way, this is both of these gentlemen that are here with us tonight are running for various offices. Because this is a community radio station, we cannot get into actually designating anything more than that. I'm sure you'll recognize a friend of all and an activist for a long time, Xander Patterson.
Hello, everybody.
Right. And, I'm familiar with both of these gentlemen, and rather than me stumble around with a bio, how about each one of you kind of introducing yourself and a little bit of some of the kinds of things that you've been involved in over the years. Mr. Patterson?
Well, I'm a longtime progressive activist. I first got involved actually hosting a Friday radio zine here on KBOO.
Well, what year was that?
I think 1987. I discovered KBOO listening to the Iran-Contra hearings, grovel to grovel, and came down and started to volunteer. And for some reason, there were quickly a bunch of openings, and I got on the show co-hosting with Marlena Smith.
And I'll bet you there's still a lot of people out there that remember that, remember your show, and will remember you.
Sure, and I still always come in and pitch at least one shift during Pledge Drive. And so I'm certainly no stranger to KBOO, especially since my wife is a former station manager and news director. Mm. That's Denise Kowalczyk. So, yes, I'm still very,
still part
very
of the
much
family.
Involved in the KBOO community. Mm. But at that same time, for a living, I was into recycling when it was still developing. I've been involved in peace issues. After KBOO, I went down to Central America and did some freelance reporting covering the civil wars there and U.S. policy. And currently, I have an elected office on the all-powerful East Multnomah Soil and Water Conservation District. I've been a Green Party activist for many years. I was a statewide coordinator for the Nader campaign in 2000. And I've been on boards and volunteered in all kinds of organizations.
So that, with that kind of a background, that gives you a broad scope of a number of different kinds of things that affect our voters and our citizens. And so as we get into the other part of the dialogue, I think that's some good background information for people to understand.
Absolutely.
All right. The eminent Mr. Broussard.
Well, you know, it's so nice to be back with family for a while.
Yes, indeed.
I've sort of taken a leave of absence, if you will.
Yes, indeed.
You're a KBOO programmer as well, right?
Yeah, right. Very much so here. In fact, on this particular piece, Proverbial Perspective. And, you know, I think back the time in terms of my involvement. It goes all the way back to Northeast Spectrum. Remember the old Northeast Spectrum off of Sandy Avenue? I did cable access. Mm-hmm. Did cable access, in the old days. Been doing that about 15, 20 years. And at one point in time, we actually had a hookup with cable. So we were actually simulcast. It was really neat.
It was really neat.
And we actually went out into the community and we actually did shows in the community and simulcast on both pieces.
Right.
I thought that was very, very creative, and hopefully you might be able to.
That's a good idea. I hadn't been involved at that time, didn't know that that was happening.
What era was that? Was that 70s,
80s? It was in the 80s, up in the 80s aspect. But it was real good because some people, you know, one, didn't have access to television.
Right.
They couldn't afford the cost, if you will, and even today. You know, seniors don't have access, but they do have access to cable.
Right.
You got me? But sometimes there's some very interesting shows that you have at cable, and I do cable now. I do cable with Oregon Voters Digest, and I do that. And that the format is still there, you know, informational, educational kind of a format piece. And I think that's very, very important. You know, people need to be educated, you know, and because issues comes in the form of either individuals or ballot measures, or elections, and the like. And I guess that's the neat thing, and that's why I continue to relate with KBOO, because, it's in an informational educational format. We need to know, and a lot of times the people on the lower end of the spectrum don't have access.
Right.
And I think it's very important to do that. So, anyway,
well, that's
it's just
a
been
good lead into one of the things when you mentioned the word access is that I think it'd be very good for our listeners to hear each one of you talk a little bit about what are your views in terms of practical things, strategic things that could happen that encourages access to younger populations, the ones that are just barely getting of an age to get ready to start thinking about voting, or the ones that are just now eligible. And as we all know, that that's one of the things that we saw some spark in that area during the last presidential election when there were different groups that were mobilizing youth to get actively involved and so forth. But what ideas might you have about, how do we go about attracting the younger people to getting involved in the political process?
So you're talking electoral politics here?
Yes.
Boy, I think it's a tough one. The sense of disconnection and alienation and disillusionment out there in every age group is really amazing. I see this constantly as I go door-to-door canvassing.
What is it that you notice?
Well, people think that the political debate is really irrelevant, that the candidates that are available and viable are not addressing issues that are of concern to them, and that the solutions are tremendously circumscribed by external powers that be. For example, I think taxes are a huge issue now, and how do we fund government? And I think a lot of viable solutions, like progressive taxes, where the rich and corporate pay their fair share, people may support that, but then they think, oh, no, it can't happen because the powers that be will never let it happen. So I think one of the first things we can do to get people engaged is to have a much more relevant, much broader conversation, and where a wider variety of solutions are on the table. I think that the voter-owned elections, public campaign finance, we may disagree on this, I'm not sure, but...
Let's talk about that.
Yeah, I think that's probably the single most important political reform that we could have in the system.
Why do you say that? What makes
for
so
two
important?
Reasons. One, because it makes it possible for somebody who's not connected to the rich and powerful to run a viable campaign, and two, to qualify for the voter-owned elections. Maybe I should explain what this is. This allows public campaign finance to people who are able to raise $1,005 contributions. Then they get a bunch of money from the city, like $150,000 for the primary, I think, and then another $200,000 if they make it past the primary to the general election, which is enough to run a good, credible campaign. But part of what's good about it is that, yes, it makes it more accessible to, say, just community activists like us who don't have access to the deep pockets, but also the process of raising $1,005 contributions requires you to go out and engage the community and talk to people and get that support. Getting $5 out of somebody, it's not much. It's not more than almost anybody can afford, but it's still a statement, and people aren't just going to go tossing it out unless they support what you're doing.
Well, let's let Mr. Broussard speak to this.
Well, in all due respect, I think it's long overdue as far as campaign finance reforms, if you will. And this is, as far as I'm thinking, we're going in the right direction. I guess the only concern I had was that in certain communities, in some areas where poverty areas are, let's say like the African-American community, which has been an issue for a number of years in terms of getting them to register to vote, okay? Well, in this particular situation, as you know, one doesn't have to be a registered voter. You got me? And then a person who's a green carder could sign it, and even a minor could sign it also, too.
Really, so, you don't have to be a registered voter?
No, you don't have to be a registered voter. So my point is that I was more into what's input to output. You know, in order to actually get into the voting process, you have to be a registered voter. You see what I'm saying? So my thought was it should have been the same requirement on the front end, that it should be a registered voter. And in that way, as you say, when one goes out, those individuals who are not registered to vote, they would then be encouraged, i.e. through your marketing skill or whatever's necessary, telling them about getting them involved. And a lot of times the other thing is about the green card situation. You know, it has been a number of people that have been residing in this country for a number of years and have actually been be able to participate in a number of deals, but they're not actually American citizens. You got me? Mm-hmm. So, again, that would have been another way to get them involved in our process, therefore be a little bit more enthusiastic about some of the issues that we're involved in. So that was the only concern that I had. The minors, I mean, it was even said to me that when I first filed, and then I got into understanding what it was all about, that from the city, that a person could be 5 years old, or they could break up their piggy bank. Well, to me, the election process is not a joke, you know, and at the same time, as far as young people are concerned, I really feel very strong about the fact that they should be given the opportunity to really enjoy those formative years. They're going to have enough time getting in our area. So I have some concern with right. that part of it. So, but on the other hand, it's going in the right direction, and I still think that maybe the next go around, there might be some considerations to tweak it a bit and can see the value, if you will, of trying to promote more voters to get into the process. And then that situation, that's really where the rubber meets the road. Because I really not realize right now, we're very excited, as you know, in the city, with the Francis Coney race, with the city of Portland, the $1 million and this, that, and the other. And, you know, it has been a kind of a golden rule. He who has the gold rule. You know what I mean? And then you got the whole PGE piece, the whole against Eric Stent. That's really what that is. So that really isn't, that's a whole separate issue. as far as I'm concerned. That's a whole separate issue in itself in terms of as far as the election process on the other side of the situation. It doesn't help the situation out with that in the mix also, too. So that was my concern.
Right. What other kind of ways are both of you looking at in terms of reducing barriers to the younger voters? What other kind of things can help get that outreach? Now, you mentioned, Mr. Patterson, you mentioned one thing about broadening the issues, making issues more relevant to people so they could feel it. And you were talking about the same kind of thing even in terms of various populations, particularly those who may, English might not be their first language, but the issues that they're concerned about are slightly different too. So how do we reach the younger people in these various groups?
Well, one area that I would say, Robert, like I said, in to qualify to be a voter, you have to be 18 years of age, an American citizen. Now, that is considered the threshold, the entree, if you will, to adulthood. And I think that's a responsible aspect of it. So, to me, again, that goes right back to the whole issue about the justification for making these people required and whatever. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the right age, you know, because as you know, we've all gone to school and this, that, and the other, and we all get in some various activist kind of a situation. Normally it's in the college arena or whatever, but when you're 18 years old, I think that's the start, and I think that's where the focus should be, to talk to those individuals. And then at the same time, again, the motivation, because then they can register to vote. They could actually get into the process.
Well, Mr. Patterson, what's your thought on that?
Gosh, well, yeah, it's funny. 18 became the voting age. It used to be 21, I think, during the Vietnam War, because the people got a little bit touchy about being able to be drafted into war and get killed without having the right to vote.
Mm-hmm.
But I knocked on a door last night, and there was a young woman who said, I asked if she was registered to vote. She said no, and she didn't think most of the other kids in the house were. She said, well, you know, we're young people. You know young people don't vote. And we got to talking. I asked what they did, and she said they were like anarchist types who actually work at places like Outside In. So these are people who have a real social commitment and are out there doing good stuff, and yet they don't look at electoral politics and government, even though government funds perhaps the organizations that they're working in, as a viable means of any kind of positive social change in this country. And I think part of the reason for that is because it hasn't been for 25 years a means of really progressive change. So I think that people will start to care when it becomes more relevant to their lives.
Well,
in America, you can almost tell an issue is important because the government isn't doing anything about it, like child care or health care or something.
I have another thought to throw a very...
Yeah, what do you think, Wiley G?
I'll tell you what I think. I agree with the things that you've said so far, but I think that they should be reached before they're 18.
I agree.
I think that there should be some preparation so that by the time they're 18, they're raring to go. They know what it's about, and they want to jump right in because that's when they legally can do it. So I think some of the discourse, some of the discussion that happens by parents, by teachers, and by people in office, whether they're candidates or already in office, should be trying to get the parents to talk to the students. One of the kind of or the students or young people, you know, whether they're a student or not, because I know from a number of families in neighborhoods that I grew up in Los Angeles, when I was young, we used to have very interested and I must admit sometimes heated discussions at the family table.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody would be talking about some issue that was going on in the city and us kids would be listening and mom would be saying this and pop would be saying that and we'd have to kind of figure out, well, you know, what's all going on?
Mm-hmm.
It didn't necessarily translate out into, you know, clear and detailed understanding of everything, but we understood about when they were talking about national politics or who's going to be elected president or some of the big kind of things, even at a younger age, 10, 12, 14, can begin to understand. And that plants a seedbed so that by the time they get 18, it's not a foreign thought. What do you think of that?
Absolutely. And you learn to know that, or you learn to believe that that politics matter and that social affairs matter. I grew up in the same kind of environment where grew up in New York, so we were, The New York Times was always there, and we watched the news every night while making dinner or something. And Although I can't say my politics are the same as my parents by any stretch. At least they got the same kind of civic
engagement. But you had some interesting dialogue.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Good example.
I would say today that...
Did you grow up in that kind of environment?
Oh, yeah. It was beautiful. I mean, the fact of the matter is, I mean, money wasn't the major factor. You know, there were smaller areas. You actually knew the candidate. You got me. It wasn't the money. I mean, the person actually was doing the hands-on situation. Money is more of a factor today than it was when I was coming up.
That's true, you know, because we used to have people coming to the house and knock on the door.
Exactly.
Sit down
with you, you knew
porch.
Them, et cetera. And I guess that's why the big deal about campaign finance reform. It's about really reacting to the money the person controls. Because when you start thinking about the money, it's all about getting your name out, getting your face out. You have to buy commercials. And it's kind of interesting, when I made the thought or the concerns out to the media, they weren't interested because, in all due respect, it's their money. And when you look at some of the guidelines, I mean, it's going to be a pretty strict from the standpoint. That's their money. That's their bonanza time, if you will. And so they're not too interested, if you will, in what we are talking about. We're talking about true representation and making sure that that's where my head's at. You know, getting down to the people and talking to the real needs of this country. I mean, just like healthcare. You know, people talk about healthcare. But when you start looking at the numbers between presidential elections, people don't vote. And that's why I'm saying that if people voted, you see, and that's what would actually motivate and mobilize these folks to vote on those issues. But the way it's set up right now, so what? It's blasé.
One other aspect just in terms of communication with people, obviously it's pretty clear that different people have different kinds of communication style. In addition, mm-hmm. aside from the substance, the content, but in terms of reaching people, one of the things I remember hearing a number of times after the last election was that people of one kind of persuasion, let's say conservative, talk in such a way that they're always preaching to the choir, and that people on the progressive side do the same thing. So they're always talking to each other, and so where does the crossover occur so that people as citizens, as family members, as members of the community begin to hear things so that they don't see necessarily a real demarcation? Oh, if you talk in this way, well, you're only talking to this kind of audience and that. How does that, where does that crossover happen, and how does that have an effect on inciting or empowering dialogue that goes beyond party labels?
That's a good question. I think one of the big problems we have in the country is we're living in parallel universes, maybe quite a few different parallel universes. And as much as I like the idea of a more diversified media, and as a KBOO supporter, I'm really into that, not having it more filtered through three major networks has allowed us to fragment in a big way. I was executive director of Physicians for Social Responsibility, the Oregon chapter. And one thing I did there was give a presentation on an alternative to the war on terrorism, preaching the gospel of international law and international cooperation grounded in the rule of law. And I gave this PowerPoint presentation to Rotary clubs and people not in the choir, not in the peace movement.
Right.
And a couple of times people said some pretty unpleasant things, and I feel lucky to have gotten out of banned and alive talking to Rotary clubs and Kiwanis clubs and stuff there. But actually, I found that, you know, it was very hard to do at first, but after I got comfortable with it, it was possible to, much more possible than I had thought at first, to have a dialogue if we try. But a large part of it is, you know, we have to take responsibility for getting out of our comfort zone.
Well, see, now, you're hitting on several key points, and I really applaud you for making the effort. And I bet you, it sounded from what you're saying, that you yourself learned a lot out of that process. But you got to get out of the comfort zone and reach across and attempt. And it may not necessarily be easy to talk to people who you're pretty sure are a different perspective than where you're coming from. But as you yourself experience, that some of what you had to say did get heard.
Well, one thing I learned is that there is still a bedrock of common values, I think. And if you start with the things that you have in common and then sort of broach where your paths divide and sort of grow to understand that and talk about it, it works much better than starting, especially not with accusation or something, but start with a common, not with the wherever the points of disagreement.
Well, Mr. Broussard, you've had a lot of experience with that very thing too, because I know from watching you over the years, you have been effective with various different kind of communities. I imagine that there's some communities that you've been in. We're not going to go into party
or anything like that. No matter with me, they all look alike to me.
No, but some of the communities have been very different.
Yeah.
From some of the other things that you've been in. So what's your experience like?
Well, like you said,
the crossover.
I agree with you. I mean, I would agree with what you're saying. You know, I mean, in all due respect, just the opportunity to been able to be on the air really gave me the experience, if you will, OJT, to understand what Crossroads was about and also the effectiveness of crossover. And it takes time, you know, and so that's why, again, my format is sort of an informational education. I listen. I allow the subject matter to articulate their position. You got me? And then we have the discussion around the individual. And you don't get in trouble. I don't try to counter a number of the things. It's you know, hey, it's the person, because we're all creatures of our exposure. You know, and I think once you get that respect, and you can deal with crossover with no problem. But how many folks can do that? You know, in most cases, it's all an individualistic thing. This is my turf, my piece, and I don't want you to bother it. You get my point? And a lot of times, that's where I think a lot of the confusion gets in the whole piece. And I think it's even more difficult today because of the immigrations, the immigrant situation. We got a bunch of folks coming into this country, and a number of them have grown up, and that's why you see the diversity from the standpoint where folks are kind of focusing on their own little piece. It's not the old crowd anymore. It's a whole new crowd. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's kind of like
This is KBOO, 90.7 FM on your dial. We want to remind all our listeners that this is call in, and I'll repeat the number. It's 503-231-8187, and we really encourage you to join us in this fireside chat, as it were, because as you can see, we're trying to use a little more a little more flexible kind of a format tonight, and so we'd like to hear from you. But go ahead and give that number a call, 503-231-8187, and shortly we're going to take a little break, and we'll be back shortly and continue the discussion.
We will not bow down to racism. Yeah, we will not bow down to injustice. We will not bow down to exploitation. What you gonna do?
I'm gonna stand.
I just can't tolerate racism. I just can't tolerate injustice. I just won't tolerate exploitation. What you gonna do?
I'm gonna stand.
We will not obey racism. We will not obey injustice. We will not obey exploitation. I'm gonna stand.
I'm gonna stand.
love. I bought the cook, but the food not enough. We're gonna talk to the music. We're talking.
And welcome back. This is Proverbial Perspectives and a series that's on the public forum, community forum for the political process. And so in the meantime, we had been talking among ourselves about some other aspects. We've touched on reaching out to various populations, particularly younger populations, and some things to do with that. And there are a number of kind of issues that we face it just seems perennially. And there's a growing consciousness that we need to address these things. And how do candidates begin to help bring people into the process by speaking to things like health and environment and things like that? Have you got some thoughts on that, Mr. Broussard?
Well, your first point about candidates, in all due respect, the candidate today has to be a very diversified individual. I mean, it's a person that's really has had the exposure. You have to have exposure. We're in dire need of good leadership. And it's just kind of like saying in so many words, we just don't need a specialist.
Mm-hmm.
We need a person.
Or one issue person.
No, uh-huh. That's not what we need.
Right.
You know, we really need someone that's had some exposure on a number of subject matters. So therefore, because everybody's thriving in their own way when you're talking to them about their own piece, you have to have some idea so that you can know how to listen about them. Because sometimes they can come up with some good ideas.
That's right.
People come up with some good ideas, and you want to share those ideas
exactly.
Once you get into a position of whatever. And I guess the other side of it, when you start thinking about the whole issue of recycling, for instance, I think we're rich along that line in the state of Oregon. We have strong environmentalists. We got a metro, if you will. Here within within our region, metro region, and they've got some very major programs that focus on recycling.
Right.
I mean, you just can't just burn material all over the place. You just can't just. I mean, garbage is clean here.
Right.
You know what I mean? I mean, it's well taken care of. Let's put it that way. We've got a 50% requirement right here in the city of Portland.
Right.
And naturally, we're looking for more.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And I also know that the whole issue, if you notice, our streets are cleaner. You got me? We're responding, if you will, to wastewater.
Right.
I mean, we just approved this new big pipe project.
Big pipe project.
To try to counter some of the stuff going into
the halls of cable.
You know, so I think we got a very active piece. We just
you don't see us about. Doing like New York is and putting all their garbage on a barge shipping it out and let it drift away out into the ocean.
It's off.
Actually, we do ship it pretty far to Arlington.
Is that the sludge? Toxic sludge you're thinking about?
Garbage. There's a big landfill that's, over 100 miles to the east of us, up the gorge.
Well managed.
Yeah.
Well managed. Methane gas. I mean, it has its own power base. I mean, and you've seen the advertisement before. I mean, it gets to the point where they can do landfilling and they make parks over them. I mean, they're safer as opposed to in the past, you dig a hole and you throw it in.
And that's it.
Yeah. And then you have leachate and all kinds of things and whatever.
Right.
Well, we're sensitive to that. And that's one of the reasons why we went out to Arlington. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And so they're very, very sensitive to it. So I think we're right on target. I mean, you know, you got the governor now talking about the kinds of fuels we burn. That's very aggressive, but I think it's a very positive way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's not too well liked by introducing that kind of situation because you're talking about the economic ends on the other end.
Right.
We're talking about light rail.
Yes.
I mean, we're pushing light rail here within our area. So that bicycling, if you will. I mean, that's another big piece. We're making bicycling available, if you will.
And you're saying these are all topics that you could actually talk to other audiences, younger audiences, or people who
and put in the classroom.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Educate folks.
Right.
Not make it so political.
Yeah.
Take the politics out of it.
Mr. Patterson.
What issues do you think either of you, both of you, are most important to kids these days and would get youth most engaged?
Well, it's always real difficult to talk about any generic group like kids. So for me, it has to do with getting an understanding of the particular groups of kids that you're talking about, because there are groups of kids that are definitely very much interested in environment and others that are not. They're interested in other things. And so the secret is there's no one magic bullet, of course, that's going to reach all young people, and it's devising varieties of things. So one of the keys that Mr. Broussard was referring to is by ourselves as adults or as activists or as candidates or whatever, getting more and more experience with different groups of kids, we would find ways that we could reach them. I remember in the last presidential election, there was this group called, the Hip Hop Nation or something like that, and through using hip-hop artists and hip-hop music, they were able to galvanize a significant group. A number of young people to at least pay attention, get interested, and even get involved. And some of them were actually too young to vote. But that's that point that I'm talking about, is that I really want to kind of keep reinforcing the notion of not necessarily waiting until people are 18, but trying to find ways to begin to plant seeds in their mind early on.
And part of it, as you suggested, is speaking their language, and which, gosh, I must say that I'm not terribly up on popular culture these days.
You're not alone.
Right? But and the other thing is to listen and find out what people care about and address those issues. Mm-hmm. And then the final component is to show how public policy does affect people's lives.
That's real key. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because that's real important.
A lot of people don't realize how much these things, many forms of public policy, stuff like you're saying, public transit or making bicycling available. Obviously, there's a big bicycle movement in Portland, and it's growing fast. And one of the reasons it's growing is because government has been very responsive to making it safe and easy, and there's been a really vibrant public dialogue to resolve the conflict or improve relations between pedestrians, bicyclists, and motor vehicle drivers.
Exactly. So
I myself haven't owned a car in 15 years.
Was that right?
Yeah, and Portland has always been just by its nature, a pretty good bike city, but it's gotten much, much better.
Could you believe the extent that it's gotten now? Because I remember, and I know you do, the time before it was bicycle-friendly, before there was those kind of special lanes. Mm-hmm. And at the time when they first started putting some in, I mean, it was blowing my mind. I had never even entertained the concept that you could do that. Mm-hmm. And now you can find those bicycle lanes all over the city.
Right.
In fact, they even have special trails that are kind of rustic trails along rivers and riverbeds.
Oh, that's the best. Yeah, the one down to Oaks Bottom is just fantastic, and it's just so much more pleasant to ride your bike when you're not surrounded by cars. And we could do much, much better. Amsterdam, for example, has really made a big push over the last maybe 30 years to make it a super bicycle-friendly city, and now something like 40% of trips are in bicycles there, and it's still only like 2 or 3% in Portland.
Right.
We're heading in that direction, and part of it is just we've been very responsive to what people want, and that has been a very youth-driven kind of movement, too.
Exactly. That's another area that could really reach out and reach those who are very interested in that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. And its progress depends on us electing officials who care about that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
You know, one area that I would like to caution and put on the table is that when you think about youth today, unfortunately, unlike when we were coming up, voc ed was there in the schools. I mean, that's like in the point, especially in these urban metropolitan type areas. For some strange reason, it's all economics. There's a lot of other influx. So a lot of kids are really losing out, if you will, on developing their minds because they don't have these other activities. Mm-hmm. We've taken music out of the schools. We've taken shop and
art.
We're talking a number of art. We've taken a number of issues. You know, kids are now having to pay to play football and basketball and activities because those are doing the developmental stage. And so I think we're losing a little of the responsibility. And sometimes, you know, depending upon the direction we're going in urban areas aspect of it, it has been said that the ratio of families to non-families in the Portland metro is 80% to 20%.
Right.
Only 20%. So when you start thinking about bicycling,
yes,
and going back to the bicycling, that's the only concern I had about that piece aspect of it.
There's
a focus to make sure that it works,
yes,
but not a focus to make the schools work.
Right.
You see what I'm saying?
Right.
If that energy would all goes towards the kids in those schools,
yes,
then it wouldn't be an issue.
Right.
It wouldn't be issues about teachers. It wouldn't
right.
be no laying the teachers off. It wouldn't be issues about closing the schools. People could be looking at schools as mini parks and leaving them open, you know, leasing the building out, making them senior citizen centers and a lot of other activities. But we're not focusing on that arena anymore. You see what I'm saying? The mindset is not family.
I think the program, the problem to a great extent is that the focus or the decision making for funding schools switched from a local property tax to a state income tax base.
Wasn't that around the time of the Prop 5?
Measure 5. That's what it did. And unfortunately, the state has just consistently underfunded education since then, and the Portland schools have really deteriorated, especially by losing all of those extracurricular activities you talked about, Bruce. And I think that's a real travesty, and I think we do have to figure out how we're going to I think we have to stop imagining that Salem is going to rise to the occasion at some point, because maybe they will, maybe they won't, but we certainly can't depend on it, and it hasn't happened for a long time. So we have to have a really, really serious discussion about how we are going to fund schools on the local level. And I've got some ideas about that I'd be very happy to discuss. And
We've touched into it, and I want you to go ahead and talk on that and also make this connection. One of the things we talked about, mentioned at the beginning, was people, and we have repeated that, connecting the dots. In other words, I don't think that a lot of people really, at least at the time, maybe by now, saw the connection between the double whammy of Measure 5 in terms of capping the amount of funding that people could develop locally, but also local control. So it was a double whammy that hit the school districts throughout the state, particularly this metropolitan area, because a lot of the special services that students were able to get, people come from even outside of our metropolitan area to take advantage of those But now, with funding so short and special programs cut and so forth, that double whammy of Measure 5, isn't it that time to have that Measure 5 revisited?
Yeah, or at least supplemented. I mean, I do support the idea of having better statewide funding, because prior to Measure 5, the problem was that the rest of the state was underfunding education because they didn't have the property tax base that we had in Portland. So Portland schools were great, but the rest of the state was suffering. And now the schools in most of the rest of the state have improved a lot, and that's a good thing. And I'm even happy that Portland does export some money to the rest of the state to supplement their schools, because this is where the money is made in the state. But we do need to figure out how we're going to get enough funding locally. And I think you talked about connecting the dots. There's one incredibly huge dot that has not been connected, or there's a couple. And that is the reason we've got a funding crisis on all levels of government for all of our social services, not just schools, is because for 25 years we've been giving giant irresponsible tax cuts to a very small number of very rich people and very big corporations. If businesses were paying the same taxes they were in Oregon that they were 20 years ago, the state would have $2 billion more in its budget, and we wouldn't be having a school funding crisis.
I agree with that. I really agree with that. I've seen that happen. And I'm not sure if I recall, or maybe you do, the particular measures that got passed that actually was the same one.
And
it was part of Measure 5, too?
Yeah, to a great extent. And I think this was not planned. It was more of an unintended consequence. But the way it worked in capping property taxes didn't help residential property owners so much, because it's based on assessed value, which was at that time a lot lower than market value. So local governments were able to increase the assessed value to bring it closer to market and raise more taxes from them. But in commercial and industrial property, assessed value and market value were already pretty much in line. And so the real beneficiaries of the real huge tax cuts went to commercial and industrial property owners.
Uh-huh.
And it used to be that 40% or so of the school budgets were came from commercial sources, and now it's down to like 15 or 20%.
That's a real inequity, real imbalance.
And there's another really important dot here, if I may go on.
Sure.
And that is that people haven't understood that that's the reason that most people are still paying the same taxes that they always were, but they're seeing less and less services.
Yes.
And they're wondering, what the heck is this? And they think, oh, it's because government must be more inefficient, or it's teachers are paid too much, or administration is too high. And that's not what's happening. It's not that government's any less efficient than it ever was. Sure, there's some inefficiencies. But no, the problem is really that services have been cut for things we all care about, but taxes have only been cut for a small number of rich people and big corporations. And so people feel like they're getting less for their tax dollar, because they are. And that's what we really, really, really have to talk about. And when we find a solution, it's got to be to make the people who receive those big tax cuts pay their fair share.
You have a comment on that, Mr. Bassani?
I guess I'm hearing where you're coming from. In fact, what I'm reminded of the discussion we're having right now. The mayor, as you know, has been trying to get a handle on the issue, and he initially called in the parents. That was basically the parents, that 20%, and he had a rally with them, and they talked about it and kind of got their ideas. Then he had a rally, if you will, with some of the business leaders and the like. You know, over here at the Coliseum or whatever.
And the summit.
That was the second summit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's still, but in all due respect, the responsibility should be in the legislature. That's where they should solve the problem. So I think that he needs one more summit. He needs to have a Portland delegation, you know what I mean, the legislative delegation, the congressional delegation, the senatorial delegation, and have that conference, if you will, that summit, with a transparent deal like he's been doing. And I think that's good. That's very effective, because...
Sure, I'd agree with you there. I agree.
They need one more.
The state mm-hmm. should fund it, but I don't think that we can afford to sort of sit down and wait for that to happen while our schools go down the tubes. We're going to lose, they've already been cut to the bone, and now they're going to lose another 12-14% of their budget next year. We're talking, you know, a third of the school year disappearing.
But what do you think? But let's say this. Let's take the politics off the kids' back. Let's make sure that those kids are in school. Let's make sure that there's a teacher for those kids. So as far as I'm concerned, I want to hear about no shortage in school days. I want the kids to know and feel comfortable about the fact there's going to be school on such and such a day, and I'm going to be there, and my teacher's going to be there. And then we as grown up take care of that issue. Let's get away from threatening the kids that they're not going to be there, or the parents who are working trying to make it, and there's nowhere in the world they're there for little junior, and they can't afford it. So my point is that, and then that's where that problem that we have, that 80-20. The 80% say, hey, it's not my kid. I could care less. So what? And a lot of times those are the folks that are being asked to
So
to
how
solve
do we
the
reach
problem.
Them? How do we reach that 80%?
Well, like I said, we in many ways, you know, the diversity aspect of it, in all due respect, we've gotten very progressive. We went through birth control, we went through a lot of things, and it wasn't attractive to have a family. Or if not that, it was too expensive to have a family. You got me? And so, we're transitioning, but we got to have some families to continue to perpetuate our way of life. Because at some point in time, we're going to all be pushing daisies.
So how do you propose we reach that 80%?
Well, I think just by communicating the really basic economic truth that all of our well-being depends on having a well-educated population. Everybody from Alan Greenspan to the business community, everybody will tell you that the single most important economic driver is a well-educated population.
Yes.
And so everybody benefits if we have well-educated kids. And I think most people realize that, and the stumbling block really comes into figuring out how we're going to fund it. And I think the problem with Potter's tax plan is that it's essentially a pretty flat tax, and people don't want to continue to pay more and more when they see Bush giving out these giant tax cuts to the rich and corporate. I mean, something like 40% of the Bush tax cuts went to the richest 1%. We should make them pay their fair share on the local level, basically repeal the Bush tax cuts on the local level to fund our schools.
But he is forcing the discussion, and that's what I like. Mm-hmm. He's forcing it to say, he's put it on the table. Yeah. He's saying, hey, you guys fix it. Don't look at me as just a one person to solve your problem. We're going to have to sign this.
You're
problem.
Talking about Mayor Potter?
I'm talking about Mayor Potter. Yeah. This is a nonpartisan issue.
Right.
This is not a partisan issue. I admire his courage tremendously for doing this, and I think he's absolutely
engaged.
But what I think is really missing from the conversation are two things. One, that it's not just our schools that are suffering the death of 1,000 cuts, but all of our social services. I serve on a county citizen budget advisory committee dealing with safety net issues, and we are literally trying to decide what programs. Do we cut the one to prevent child abuse, or do we throw some mentally ill seniors out in the street? That is totally inhumane, immoral, and unwise.
Shouldn't we even put in that position of making those kind of choices?
Everybody's fighting for their program.
No, but
let's
those
cut
are,
that one, but not mine.
No, but if you, I think if you actually go through the budget the way I have and look at the programs that are out there, there are not any really superfluous programs. We're talking vital stuff here. I'm not kidding when I say it's a choice between a child abuse prevention program and treating mentally ill seniors.
But you would agree we're going to have to make some hard choices.
I think somebody's the hard choice we have to make is how we're going to get more revenue. I don't think that in the richest country in the world we need to be making choices like that. The choice we need to be making is how do we get the CEOs who are now making 400 times as much as the shop floor people pay their fair share. Why have we been giving giant tax cuts to the people who are already making the most out of an economy that is increasingly polarized between rich and poor? It seems just crazy to me.
Well, got to get out the vote. That's the key. The little people at the bottom aren't registered. They don't vote. It's about numbers.
I think you guys, the two of you are going to be encouraging the vote. I think this is a very good dialogue. These are the kind of things that we need to talk about. Yes. And quit, guys are talking right specifically to it. Not tiptoeing around the real issues. And those are some of the real issues. And it makes people uncomfortable to hear about it.
It also makes them engaged. I think that when we can start having this kind of conversation and at these summits that Potter has, instead of the very circumscribed ones that they have, that talks about reality in a candid way instead of this sort of, mushy, mealy-mouthed platitudes that politicians so often use, then I think people will start to care.
Right, I think so. People rise to the occasion when you really treat them with respect and dignity and respecting the fact that they are intelligent.
And see, here at Cable,
they can understand.
That is so crucial.
And here at Cable, we have summits all the time, little mini summits like we're having right here.
Exactly, exactly.
But a lot of times they don't listen, right?
Right.
Get out and vote.
That's right.
Well, you got to do politics or politics will be done to you.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, we're getting close to wrapping up our time. And are there any kind of parting thoughts that the two of you'd like to share?
Well, I would say that I'm optimistic. You know, I think we're gonna work ourselves out of that. But I would hope, especially from the educational standpoint, because that's our future. Keep those kids in schools. Keep those teachers in school. Don't sell your schools. You know what I mean? Let's work it out. But let's not disrupt, if you will, the progression in regards to our education system. Those are our futures. Without that, we have nothing.
I agree completely, and that means figuring out how to fund it in a fair way.
That's right, and we do have answers, right?
I'm
going to get him on my show, get you guys on. Talk a little bit more about this,
yes.
Which is good.
Well, it's been a real pleasure to be back on Cable
right.
Wiley
it
G.
Is.
I always owe you a debt of gratitude. I really appreciate it, and it's, you know, having the two of you here back in the Cable Studios, old home week.
Well, hey, I want to say to the family, you know, it's alive and well. Look like it's in good hands. And it's not Allstate, it's Wiley.
Cheers to that.
So I want to
thank you
very much.
And, appreciate it.
Yeah, so we'll continue the dialogue.
Yeah, that's a good deal.
La caña.